Hi, everyone. We're back here to the Neil Haley Show in the Total Celebrity segment. I'm excited to welcome the program Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick. Rick, thanks for stopping by. How are you, man?
Nielsen and Neil. How about that?
Hey, a perfect combination. I'm waiting for that co-host and all that stuff to come on board. So let's talk about starting out. Did you always want to be in music, Rick?
Yeah. My parents were musicians. My father was an opera singer, so it was like, I was around music, but it just wasn't my type. But I started out as a drummer, and about the time I was involved with the closest to guitar I was like with the Ventures, bands like that. But then the Beatles came on, and I was hooked.
Really, you're hooked. You said you wanted to do it. And so how did this experience, how did you guys get together, Cheap Trick? How did that happen?
Well, let's see. I had a whole bunch of bands before Cheap Trick, but I was always in those bands. I'm the only constant since grade school till today.
Oh wow!
Who's in the band? So, but you know, I always look for the best players to play with, and luckily I found them. They were pick the best guy from this band. Pick the best guy from, but not best guy, best guy from this band. And the last that made it, the whole thing together was Robin Zander. Always looking for a singer that could sing like that.
And that was the big thing. Finding that find is what discovered you guys, right? Getting that final find, would you say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I was good. Drummer was good. Bass player was good. Like I said, I was good. And the missing cement was Robin. And still my favorite lead singer in the whole wide world.
Yeah, that's fantastic. All right, so let's kind of go into specifically, how did that big break happen?
Well, let's see. We'd been banging. Actually, I got a record deal, and Tom Peterson was on that deal. We were both just out of high school, and we got signed to Epic Records. And I was the guitar second guitarist and Mellotron players. I was the only guy in the United States that had a Mellotron at that time in 68. And we put our first record out in 1969. It's fresh out of high school, had our own deal and Epic Records. And we went no place. but we were too dumb to quit, just like Cheap Trick is. And we stuck around. And so that was 69. And a mere 9 years later, 8 years later, after starting Cheap Trick, we got our second deal, second record deal offered to us. Jack Douglas had come to see us. We were playing at a bowling alley in Waukesha, Wisconsin. He had relatives up there, and he came to see us and liked us immediately. At least, I guess that's his story. And called the record label the next morning, and we got signed in one day.
That's the great overnight success story. You know,
yeah, overnight success. 10 years after the first group. And then we made our record in 76 that didn't come out till 77. So we were like an overnight sensation. And that record didn't sell well. So it's like, and the second one didn't. And we just kept going.
So you have this attitude of not giving up then, it sounds like, in loving it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like, mm-hmm. Not bragging or whatever, but it's like I always thought we were good. I always thought the bands that we'd put together, the songs we wrote, were good. And if people didn't like it, well, there you go. If you have to tell people you're cool, you're not. So you have to wait around till people come and think you're cool. And we just stuck to our guns. We didn't. Every dumb move we'd make, if we thought it was good, then it wasn't dumb. You know, we went with it, and we're still to this day. You know, it's like we're too dumb to quit, and we have the music to prove it.
You definitely have the music to prove it. So when we talk about specifically enough rebranding the name at Cheap Trick, how did you come up with that name?
Well, the band we had before, which was the four of us minus Robin, we lived in Philadelphia and we were called Sick Man of Europe. And if that isn't the worst name on earth, every time, if you have a name of a band where people, if you tell them what it is, what? And you have to go, you have to tell them exactly what it is, because they can't, it doesn't slip off the tongue so easily. Finally, I just got tired of having like the name, whatever we had. We went to see Slade, Tom and I did, in Philadelphia at the Spectrum. And they came on, and Tom said to me, he said, God, these guys have every cheap trick in the book. They had glitter, and they had high heel shoes on, and this and that. And I said, cheap trick. Yeah, I said, that's a name. It's a household name, but it doesn't connotate anything, I don't think. But everybody would know what that is, and whether they, whatever definition they had of that, it still was like a household name. I mean, like the Rolling Stones, if they weren't really good, the Rolling Stones is just as bad as any other name. But it's,
exactly.
Every time you think of Rolling Stones, those guys. And it means something.
And Cheap Trick means something, and specifically.
Yeah, Cheap Trick means something. It's like people would say, they're Cheap Trick. It's like, where's all that sound coming from? And we were like, it was just guitar, bass, and drums. But Tom had developed by then it had developed the 12-string bass and 10-string bass, 8-string bass. And we just had a way of filling out the sound so well.
Yes.
It's like, so that everybody thought we always, even later on, people thought we always had extra instruments playing. So like U2 or something, they play and all these other instruments appear. You know what I mean? It's like we always filled out the sound with just the three pieces. And I don't know.
So the look and feel of your band, thinking about Cheap Trick, the name you came up with it, then the talk about specifically defining Cheap Trick as a gimmick, as we call in pro wrestling, gimmick. A gimmick is like, a specific character, and that was the character of the band. And then Cheap Trick is trying all the different moves to kind of put something over to make it get over. What would you say, how'd you create the style once you thought of that? You said you had the other band, you put this band together, and it starts to take off, the look, the feel at that time in the 70s for music, and figuring out how that band's aura and reputation and brand looked.
Well, myself, as like I was never going to be a Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, Keith Richards kind of guy. I was always a class clown at school. And it's like, if I tried to dress up and look like any of those guys, like I was a rock star, it just wasn't me anyhow. I mean, it was a guitar player, songwriter. And so if I tried to be cool, if I tried to act like I was cool, I couldn't do it. If I tried to act like I'm me, the eccentric screwball, whatever, I could do that. I didn't try to look like Haystacks Balboa. I don't know if you remember him from you. Old wrestler. I actually knew a lot of the old wrestlers because I went.
Did you? Yeah, because you were near Chicago. You grew up near Chicago, right?
So. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I saw Gorgeous George with my dad.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
okay, so you were the old days. I'm 48, but I wrestled in my 20s and retired in 29 in Bremen, Germany. I wrestled before The Rock was The Rock. He wore my knee pads down south, so I was part of the Attitude Era in wrestling. So I don't know the old school era, but when I consider anything, music and wrestling, rock and wrestling went hand in hand in the 80s. So
yeah,
about the 70s. Yeah, go.
Some of those guys that. We'd play the same places that the wrestlers did. I mean, we had Andre the Giant was out with us, and I was with Brutus Beefcake.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have a story about you and Andre?
Well, Andre? Yeah, just we were at the same place.
Oh. You didn't go out drinking with him afterwards because he would have drank you.
Well, no, I went drinking with a lot of the other boys, but not when I was on, not with Andre. Which the Hart Foundation was.
Oh,
Kevin Hart,
Bret Hart, and
Bret Hart. I knew them. I actually saw him. You mentioned Germany. I met him at not the first time, but I met him at a restaurant, German restaurant in Milwaukee. And so I've known him for a long time. And plus, who's the mouth of the South?
Oh, Jimmy Hart.
Jimmy. Yeah. Jimmy. And so, you know, we're all kind of like everybody, the wrestlers and the musicians, we're all kind of misfits. You know, we don't fit into anything except what we do.
Exactly. All right. So let's talk about, so you were saying about it. Did you think it would become such a huge group? You make it as big as you did, like, you know, with the songs and the
top, well, you know,
yeah, everything. Yeah.
Like I said, I always thought we were good. And when in 1978, when we went to Japan for the first time, we developed a core audience without ever being there. And when we went there, I found these people, they got it. They understood what we were up to. We're, no offense to the U.S., but there wasn't like a national rock paper like they had in Japan. So they listened to us and they learned from us, and they it was fantastic. I thought they were the smartest people on earth, that they liked us as much as we liked ourselves. And that's why we made that record. You know, we probably played in Iowa the night before we went to Japan. We got to Japan, there's 5,000 people waiting for us at the airport. And we sold out two shows at the Budokan, which